This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 4th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Karnatz. Theater Squared has announced its 2014-2015 season lineup, including the comedy One Man, Two Governors, the Pulitzer Prize winner Proof, the family adventure Around the World in 80 Days, the premiere of Robert Ford's Look Away, and Tracy Lett's comedy drama Superior Donuts. Subscription, tickets, and more information available by calling 443-5600 or online theater2.org.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Republican Attorney General runoff candidates Leslie Rutledge and David Sterling discuss medical marijuana and the death penalty. We have highlights from a recent interview with the two candidates. Also, as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we take a look back at the desegregation of public swimming pools.
We spend a little more time in the water by paying a visit to the Siloam Springs Whitewater Recreation Park. And we savor some salsa in the latest installment of our monthly food series.
Those stories and more. But first, former President Bill Clinton says it's important that presidential libraries and other sites honoring former commanders-in-chief give Americans the context to understand how past debates affect current political fights. Speaking at a conference last night in Little Rock on presidential historic sites, Clinton said they're important in understanding where the nation is heading.
Every presidential library both has an historical mission and an obligation to try, and, you know, come on, they all think the person they represent did a pretty good job or they wouldn't be working there. But that's not the point. The point is that we should be making honest efforts to show what the relevance was to the current day.
Mr. Clinton also made a veiled reference to the potential presidential ambitions of his wife, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, saying critics from both parties continue studying his presidency partly because of her potential aspirations.
New Arkansas revenue numbers out yesterday show that in May, the state took in fewer dollars than was expected. The Department of Finance and Administration says net available revenue totaled $315 million, which is $24 million below forecast and $18 million below the same time last year. But state economist John Shelnut says we're still above forecast for the year.
Well, we see volatility like this in corporate income, and in this case, it was simply a one-month move among various corporations filing earlier than expected and earlier than last year. So it evened out in May, leaving us with a net available revenue above forecast by $52.9 million or 1.2%.
Which, Shelnut says, will allow the state to fully fund the budget for the fiscal year that ends at the end of the month.
The U.S. Marshals Museum is getting closer to its September 24th groundbreaking. The museum's finance committee yesterday approved a nearly $3.2 million budget for fiscal year 2015. Jim Dunn, Marshals Museum president and CEO, says the main difference between this budget and the previous one is that it includes the exhibit design and architectural costs in putting together plans for the museum.
We, prior to now, have not been sufficiently far along to do that. We are now, so this is an important development, and we have already gotten the exhibit designers under contract, and we're finishing up with the architect, so work will begin in earnest very, very soon.
The budget includes about $1.6 million for architectural services and fees, $808,000 for the exhibit designers, and $768,000 for operations costs. Dunn says museum officials are moving forward with the September groundbreaking because the money is already there for the first phases of the project. However, he says fundraising is far from over, as future construction phases like the building's bricks and mortar will still need to be paid for.
We have raised about $14 million, but that excludes up to $5 million from the sale of the United States commemorative coin that will go on sale in January of this year. And even though, of course, it depends on how many of these commemorative coins are sold, our expectation is that that will bring in up to $5 million. It could be less than that, but we don't know exactly. We're working very hard to market those coins in conjunction with others And then, of course, we continue to do private fundraising.
The budget will go before the U.S. Marshals Board at its annual meeting Tuesday.
The annual convention of Jehovah's Witnesses starts this weekend in Kansas City. Ken Rader, a convention spokesman and member of the Farmington Convention of Jehovah's Witnesses, says this year's convention is special.
This year's convention is classified as a regional convention. In the past, we have had what's been called district conventions. This year, each of the conventions will be larger in venue. This is also a part of international conventions. Even though our convention in Kansas City is classified as a regional convention, they also have an international convention going at the same time, and we will be having some video tie-in with that international convention.
The Kansas City Convention will have video tie-ins with the International Convention in Detroit, Michigan. Rader says in prior years, the district convention has drawn thousands to Fort Smith.
Over the past 6 years, we have had it in Fort Smith, but this year these are classified as landmark conventions because they are larger, and they're designed to give us information with a large crowd in view. The convention at Kansas City this first week, and there's going to be three different ones there over the next few weekends. For our convention, we're expecting about 16,500. Kemper Arena holds about 19,000, so it's going to be a packed house.
Rader says the theme of this year's convention is Keep Seeking First God's Kingdom. He also says this year marks the centennial of when Jehovah's Witnesses believe that Jesus Christ began to rule as King of Heaven.
The bidding war for prepared meat producer Hillshire Brands is heating up. Yesterday, Pilgrim's Pride outbid Tyson Foods acquisition offer of $6.8 billion with a counteroffer of $7.7 billion. The offer would see Hillshire shareholders paid $55 per share, which is $5 higher than the offer made by Tyson last week. Tyson officials didn't comment yesterday about the company's next move. Offers by both Pilgrim's Pride and Tyson don't include Pinnacle Foods, of which Hillshire Brands announced a potential $4.3 billion acquisition in early May.
Sam's Club has announced a new credit card cash back program for its members. On June 23rd, the warehouse retailer will debut the Sam's Club 531 program on a new co-branded MasterCard issued by GE Capital Retail Bank. The program would allow members to earn 5% cash back on fuel, 3% cash back on dining and travel, and 1% cash back on all other purchases with a $5,000 annual cap on cash back rewards. The new Sam's Club MasterCard will also be the first mass retailer-issued card to implement embedded chip technology, which makes cards harder to duplicate and provides more security from fraudulent activity.
Races for the U.S. Senate and statewide constitutional offices may command the most attention in this November's election, but one Fayetteville resident is vying for a seat on the city council. Sonia Davis Gutierrez announced yesterday she would seek the Ward 1 Position 1 seat on the council. The seat is currently held by Alderwoman Adela Gray.
Expect mostly clear skies tonight with a slight chance of rain in northwest Arkansas, lows in the lower 70s. Tomorrow, Thursday, partly cloudy with a 30% chance of midday showers, highs from 86 in northwest Arkansas to 91 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow evening, mostly cloudy with a 40% chance of showers, low of 69 in northwest Arkansas. 30% chance of showers, low of 74 in the River Valley.
This is Ozarks at Large. Next Tuesday, runoff elections will be held in Arkansas for races where no candidate got 50% of the vote. The only statewide race is for the Republican nomination for Attorney General. Leslie Rutledge and David Sterling, the two candidates in that race, recently spoke with Jacob Kaufman from our content partner KUAR in Little Rock. During their conversation, Sterling commented on a key issue, carrying out the state's death penalty.
I have offered a solution to the lethal injection statute that we have here in the state of Arkansas, moving from what we've traditionally used, which is sodium thiopental, which is the European manufacturers dried up export of that drug to the U.S. because it's used in capital punishment. Some states like Ohio and Texas, Oklahoma and Tennessee have moved to using, you know, contracting with local compounding pharmacies. Anti-death penalty advocates have used the FOI laws to find the identities of those manufacturers and have started protesting outside those facilities trying to shut them down. So what I've said is to change our drug cocktail to using pentobarbital, number one, and then excluding the identity of the domestic manufacturers from the FOI law. That way it would, I guess, give us a ready supply of it without the manufacturers being threatened to shut down. Currently, Arkansas law says, requires us to use the electric chair. When our legislature enacted lethal injection as our preferred method of execution in the early 80s, in their wisdom, they said if this lethal injection statute is ever declared unconstitutional, we shall use electrocution. And so what I've said is that as Attorney General, I'm not going to be an Eric Holder picking and choosing which laws I'm going to enforce and which ones I'm going to ignore, like Ms. Rutledge has taken a stance on this position. But current Arkansas law says that we shall be using the electrocution. And all I've said is, as Attorney General, I'll enforce the law as it's on the books, as our legislature has preferred.
And why don't you think the public has a right to know the types of drugs manufactured, or at least the place where they're being made?
Well, I think that it's a matter of having ready access to the drugs in order to take care of trying to get this death penalty statute back on track. You know, Dustin McDaniel said last summer that our death penalty system is broken. And the reason it's broken is because anti-death penalty advocates have sought to use the legal system to make executions as expensive as possible. And they put the AG's offices in all 50 states, or any state that has the death penalty in place, put them through all kinds of legal hurdles and try to drive up the expense of execution. And so to the extent that they're abusing the FOI laws in order to try to subvert the rule of law, which is execution, I mean, we've got 33 people on death row right now. We've got 33 families that are suffering. You know, we got 33 innocent victims that were brutally murdered, and now we've got 33 people waiting on death row while lawyers and politicians struggle with trying to figure out which drug is best to use to humanely execute these people. One guy that's on death row is on death row because he raped and murdered a five-year-old girl and stuffed her dead carcass into a hollowed-out tree. And here we are trying to figure out if we should, you know, I mean, Ms. Rutledge wants to work with the FDA, apparently, and try to figure out how to get her hands on some drugs. I've already offered a way to actually get the drugs necessary to execute criminals like this.
Are you arguing, then, that if the public knows something and it causes them to protest, and the result of their protest is that a program is stopped, that's justification for exempting FOI laws?
No, I'm saying that there are some limited circumstances where the FOI laws don't apply. I mean, there are exemptions as far as the governor's working papers. There's exemptions as far as many, many exemptions to the FOI laws. And all I'm talking about here is trying to get our death penalty statute back up and running, trying to get these 33 families, give them some closure as we try to honor the victims of these heinous crimes, and stop looking out necessarily for the people that have already been tried, have been found by unanimous verdict that they were guilty of these crimes. They were sentenced separately to death under our capital punishment statute, and I think we need to get that up and moving again.
Mrs. Rutledge?
First and foremost, I am in support of the death penalty, just so we're clear, but I support a responsible and reasonable approach to it. The suggestion that we can use the electric chair, which is currently in the Old State House Museum, it's in the archives, we can't just pull old Sparky out, plug it in, and start using it. It would take literally years of litigation in order to do so. And so that is irresponsible rhetoric. And quite frankly, I feel that because of Mr. Sterling's lack of experience and absolute no experience in criminal law is why he's preying on the, you know, emotions of the families of these victims that have suffered through enough in order to get votes in this election. If you don't understand criminal law and have no experience in criminal law, then you would suggest something such as this. That is just reckless and irresponsible. So that's why my proposal has been to work to obtain the drugs necessary so that way we can see these executions out. It's not to, you know, prey on people's emotions and these families that have been through so much. I'm not interested in doing that. I'm interested in seeing the law out. And also, it's a governor's decision. It's not an attorney general's decision as to whether or not we have an execution or whether or not the means that by which we carry out that execution. It's not going to be the Attorney General's decision. And again, I think that goes to a lack of understanding of the role of the Attorney General, that Mr. Sterling has above and beyond gone out of his way to bring up issues such as the electric chair, because it's just not a decision the Attorney General is going to make. And it's preying on the emotions of families that have gone through enough already.
Medical marijuana. Both of you have been outspoken about what you perceive as the overreach of the federal government, but this issue sees the most action at the state level, nationwide. If Arkansas voters decide to legalize marijuana in November, what would your response be? Mrs. Rutledge, I know Colorado's Attorney General contributed to your campaign. What would you do?
Well, first of all, I am against legalization of marijuana, and that's based on my experience as a prosecutor. I do believe that it is a gateway a drug, and I've seen how lives are affected, and not just as a prosecutor, but also working in the Department of Human Services and going to court with foster kids. We have a lot of children who not only have their families failed them, but the state is failing them. And if the medical marijuana passes, I will enforce and defend the law of the state just as, you know, any law, but and not put my own personal preferences. I'm not going to be like Eric Holder and pick and choose which laws to enforce and not. And I think that's where my opponent and I differ, is because he refuses to take a stand against marijuana. And I think that conservatives have, you know, strongly stated that, you know, they are not in support of this.
Well, thankfully, we have your opponent, Mr. Sterling, right here.
Yeah, well, that's actually a misstatement of my position on medical marijuana. My position on it is I am also opposed to it personally. But as Attorney General, it's not going to be my job to pick and choose which laws to defend and which laws to ignore. Ms. Rutledge has taken that position on the death penalty and the use of the electric chair. She refuses to take a stand on the electric chair. She's opposed to it. And so she is being like Eric Holder and picking and choosing which laws to enforce and which ones to ignore. My own personal preference is if this is on the ballot in November, personally, I will be voting against medical marijuana. However, if voters do pass that law, I will enforce that law. I will defend that law. And if voters reject it, then I will defend and current Arkansas law, drug laws, and prosecute criminals based on that, to the extent that the AG's office is involved in that.
In that particular issue, you do think that state law supersedes federal laws?
Well, I think they complement each other. I mean, state law and federal law, there are state laws on the issue and there are federal laws on the issue. And to the extent that state law changes on it, I will defend state law. If our voters in November decide that they want to legalize the use of medical marijuana, then I will defend that, even against federal laws that that prohibit it.
Leslie?
And just to be clear on the record, that the Family Council survey, my opponent, you know, refused to answer and said that he didn't have an opinion on. So he has gone on record with having no opinion. He stated publicly on his Facebook page a number of times that he has no opinion on legalizing marijuana. And, you know, when we talk about ethical standards and what we would do as Attorney General, just last week in the Arkansas News, and you were there for the news conference, and my opponent outright lied about my experience and said that I only had 2 years of law practice experience.
Right, but if we could just limit it to the subject of medical marijuana, if the state law passed, you would respect the voters?
Absolutely.
That was Leslie Rutledge and David Sterling speaking to Jacob Kaufman from our content partner KUAR in Little Rock. The two candidates are seeking the Republican nomination for Attorney General in the runoff election next Tuesday. You can hear more from the candidates on issues about experience, the Environmental Protection Agency, same-sex marriage, and the sources of campaign funds by watching the full interview on our website, OzarksAtLarge.com. The winner will face Democrat Nate Steele and Libertarian Aaron Cash.
From the Starlight Festival in Big Bear Lake, California, this is Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that brings you to the final frontier. This is Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, sitting outdoors at the Starlight Festival in Big Bear Lake, the first of its kind.
Listen to Planetary Radio tomorrow at 6 p.m. on KUAF3.
The Siloam Springs Whitewater Recreation Park is scheduled to open later this month. One engineer says one of the top priorities in engineering rapids at the park is remembering there's a responsibility to the Illinois River, which has existed for a long time.
And that's a balance. You know, we certainly have, there's critics out there that just say, leave a river alone. Don't ever touch the river. And then there's also people that have come up to me and said, look, you opened a whole new world to us. just like the gentleman before me, we can create an environment that's more controlled than a natural wild river that's raging from a storm, and we can introduce people in a safer manner to come out to the river and hopefully appreciate it and enjoy it and get something out of it. And if nothing else, you know, have a good day and have fun. It's all about fun. Come enjoy it.
That story's coming up in about 12 minutes on Ozarks at Large.
Public swimming pools across America typically open at the end of May, much to the delight of school children beginning their summer vacations. And this summer, an article about pools and race will be published in the Arkansas Historical Quarterly, titled Going Off the Deep End, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Desegregation of Little Rock's Public Swimming Pools. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spoke with author and historian John Kirk and has this report.
50 years ago, come July, the U.S. Civil Rights Act was passed, and John Kirk, Donaghy professor and chair of the History Department at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, said the new law was watershed.
The act did a number of things on a number of different levels. It was a very wide-ranging act. But first and foremost, its most immediate impact in many ways was requiring the desegregation of what they called public accommodations and facilities, which meant the desegregation of many of those facilities that had been segregated previously by so-called Jim Crow laws. So it led to a wholesale testing of facilities across the South, from lunch counters to swimming pools.
But compared to restaurants and movie theaters, swimming pools proved most difficult to desegregate.
And it raised the concerns of particularly African-American men being in states of undress in public with white women. And that taboo of miscegenation and the fear of interracial sex had been a very deep-seated psychological taboo in the segregated South, and that in particular, bringing people into close proximity in a very intimate way at swimming pools, was very much a sticking point, and therefore it was that really that kind of made swimming pools the last holdouts for desegregation throughout the 1960s.
The notion of blacks and whites bathing together, swimming in public pools or at public beaches, was unheard of in the early 20th century. Little Rock's first public swimming pool opened in 1922 in Pulaski Heights, but a much larger whites-only pool was constructed in 1941 by the Works Progress Administration, named the J. Kern Conway Pool. It's commonly called War Memorial Pool in proximity to the sports stadium. And on any given summer week, as many as 10,000 enjoyed the facility. 8 years later, in compliance with separate but equal accommodations laws, a bond issue was passed by the city to construct an African-American pool at Gillen Park, southeast of Little Rock.
And the pool at Gillen Park opened on Sunday, August 20th, 1950. And finally, by 1950, Little Rock had provided the separate but equal swimming pool that had been promised to African-Americans notionally by the nation in the Supreme Court since 1896. So it took a long time to get those equal facilities there.
Still, African-American residents pressed as early as 1963 to desegregate Little Rock's War Memorial Pool.
Well, after the 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed, one of the things that had to be done is to test those facilities. Of course, the Supreme Court in Brown and the Congress in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, they could both pave the way for desegregation. But ultimately, it fell on the shoulders of African-Americans to actually test whether facilities were desegregated. Because if African-Americans didn't test those facilities, then nobody would know if they were truly desegregated or not. So shortly after the 1964 Civil Rights Act came down, a group of NAACP activists led by Dr. Jerry Jewell, who would later become the first African-American state senator elected to the Arkansas General Assembly since the 1890s, when he was elected in 1972. He was president of the Little Rock NAACP branch at the time, and he and Elsie Bates, who was the husband of Daisy Bates, and they both owned the Arkansas State Press, the prominent state black newspaper based in Little Rock, both went to the swimming pool at War Memorial Park and took along a group of African-American youngsters with them and tried to gain access to the city pool, but they were turned away.
To solve the problem, Little Rock city manager closed both swimming pools in the summer of 1964.
And, of course, that was a similar response to what happened with the schools earlier. After the 1957 Little Rock school crisis, and the schools are desegregated there. Of course, the following year, Governor Orville Faubus closed down all the schools there so that they couldn't desegregate. So closing facilities rather than desegregate them had a history already in Little Rock.
With the 1965 summer season, both Gillam Park and War Memorial pools, by popular demand, were forced to reopen.
But the consequences of that were that people, particularly whites, began not to use the pools anymore. After they desegregated, they saw over that 1965 season a very large drop in the number of people who were attending those pools. And in the past, the pools have been a very crucial point for recreation in the summers, particularly, of course, for white children who'd had the large War Memorial swim pool to themselves. Many people in the city still remember the times spent at the pool in the summer as an important formative event, an important place of social activity, and an important place of meeting their friends and doing all those kinds of things. But after 1965, that began to subside very quickly. And once integration came, the number of swimmers plummeted over the course of that season. And the number of swimmers at those public pools, the white swimmers at those pools, has continued in a steady decline ever since that date. And you can mark the desegregation of Little Rock swim pools as the date when public swimming pools became less and less of an attraction for the white community.
Historian John Kirk writes that enforced desegregation of public facilities led to a decline in public swimming pools nationwide.
You begin to see more and more neighborhood pools, which are private pools, which again are beyond the reach of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And those neighborhood pools are run together by neighborhood communities, and they can control the racial composition of that. And often those neighborhoods are racially homogeneous neighborhoods, so they're all white neighborhoods, and they build private pools for themselves. And they are, not by law, but in fact, segregated. Mid-century, only 2,500 U.S. families owned in-ground home swimming pools. But by the end of the 20th century, that number had skyrocketed to 4 million.
And of course, private facilities like this athletic club pool in Fayetteville proliferated in the United States. John Kirk writes that attempts at interracial bathing also created conflict and pool closures in other places in Arkansas, like Helena, Forest City, and Pine Bluff. The Ozarks resorts of Bella Vista and Montanay had long operated spring-fed pools for white visitors. According to Rogers Historical Museum records, a public pool constructed at Lake Atalanta in 1948 served the all-white town for decades. But the progressive university town of Fayetteville, which has a historic African-American population, forced integration of its public pool preceding the Civil Rights Act after a small group of black activists pressed the town mayor. He agreed to open Wilson Park Pool to black children on summer mornings. But by summer's end, children of both races were swimming together. The year was 1963. War Memorial Pool in Little Rock was demolished in 1989, replaced by a much smaller aquatic center. And what about the historic African-American Gillam Park Pool? John Kirk.
It wasn't very well constructed in the first place. It started leaking very soon after construction. There were all kinds of problems because it was built way out of town. It was very isolated. A young boy drowned there in the early years, and it was he died because they couldn't get to him in time. It was miles away from hospitals. It wasn't very well staffed by lifeguards. So Gillam Park, as an attempt to provide a separate but equal pool, was never really equal anyway. And it met with a long and slow demise. You know, it was something that African Americans had in their own neighborhoods. But eventually, in 2001, it closed, and now it lies derelict. Gillam Park has gone through several different hands and ownership. But today, you can go there, and you can still see Gillam Park, but it's entrenched with mud, and it has weeds growing all around it. It's not used anymore. It's all fenced off, and it's kind of this eerily derelict site that's a remnant of the Jim Crow era.
Today, only one pool operates in one of Little Rock's African-American districts, the Southwest Community Center Pool, which opened in 1998. A popular version of John Kirk's article, Swimming Against the Tide of Desegregation in Little Rock, first appeared in the February issue of the Arkansas Times Journal of Politics and Culture. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Going off the deep end, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the desegregation of Little Rock's public swimming pools by civil rights historian John Kirk is published in the summer edition of the Arkansas Historical Quarterly. For more, visit arkansashistoricalassociation.org. Theater Squared's 6th Annual Arkansas New Play Festival will feature 4 plays performed in one weekend, June 12th through the 15th, including a fully staged production of Jamie McGaw's B-Side Myself. Seating is limited, full lineup tickets and more information available at 443-5600 or theater2.org. The Fayetteville Underground Art Gallery welcomes First Thursday on June 5th, featuring up-and-coming artist Hannah Chalew's Nature of the City, artist Allie Wood's Frederick's Transmutations, and work by Elijah John Mathis. Folk musician Adam Cox will perform. Drinks and snacks provided. FayettevilleUnderground.com for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 4th, 2014. I'm Christina Karnatz, and here with me now, Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm having the June panic.
Well, it's June 4th.
I'm late with the June panic. Oops. Antoinette is supposed to have the panic, so I know when it's time. Okay, we finally get to talk about some theater. We've talked about music and talked about music. We're going to talk about a farce by Ken Ludwig called Leading Ladies. It's on at Fort Smith Little Theater starting Thursday, and the director, Duff Taylor, says it's kind of a cross between Some Like It Hot and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Well, that sounds like fun.
How can you go wrong with that? Okay, here's the story. 2 down-on-their-luck English actors are on the Moose Lodge circuit in York, Pennsylvania in the 1950s. They hear about an old woman who is planning to leave her $3 million fortune to her niece and 2 nephews, whom she hasn't seen since they were little. So they decide, well, wouldn't it be lovely to be those nephews? And then complications and funny ensues. You can find out more about this at fslt.org. Thursday is opening night with showtime at 7:30, and shows continue through June 15th. Tickets are $25 for opening night and $10 for all the other performances.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Coming up on Ask Me Another, we take the show to St. Paul and play a game called City of Twins.
The Winklevoss twins also competed in the 2008 Summer Olympics in what event?
Synchronized luge.
Join me, Ophir Eisberg, and our VIP, author of Orange is the New Black, Piper Kerman, on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Listen to Ask Me Another, Saturdays at 11 a.m. on 91.3 FM.
Later this month, a new park will open in Siloam Springs. There are the usual park things like picnic tables, but the Whitewater Recreation Park has something different too, rapids. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellum spent yesterday morning at the almost ready for the public park and has this report.
This section of the Illinois River, about 4 miles south of downtown Siloam Springs, has always been a favorite for floaters. A natural feature here, a ledge under the water, has long provided a bit of a rush on what is sometimes a pretty sedate stretch of water. A combination of what was originally here and some recent engineering is creating even more of a rush. 2 featured rapids. The Siloam Springs Whitewater Recreation Park will officially open June 28th. But yesterday, city officials, engineers, and other interested parties took a final walkthrough. Tom Burrows, the state director for the American Canoe Association, spent some time looking at the new rapids. He says he's floated this spot before.
Well, what we have here is just a nice smooth flow, and because of the source of the water upstream, this river flows basically year-round. So even in the summertime, it's still a nice, cool place to come and play.
There are 2 obvious dramatic rapids easily seen from the bank of the river. Tom offers a brief description of what's been created.
Is a nice, smooth, glassy tongue. And what this allows is for paddlers to get out there and surf. And that's where typically we're sitting on the wave using gravity and the flow of the water both together, balancing to keep the boat in position in the water without losing distance going downstream. The next rapid farther downstream is a little bit larger, and it's a little bit faster, so it might not be as easy to surf, but it's certainly fun to paddle through.
The amenities at the park are not just in the water. There are picnic tables, paved trails, and changing rooms. Holland Hayden, the communications director for the city of Siloam Springs, says the city wanted to create a park that was not just for kayakers and canoeists.
One of the reasons the picnic tables are here, and you know, we have this kind of amphitheater seating so that you can sit down and you can watch the kayakers and the more experienced canoers and those playing in the rapids and just kind of watch and enjoy your day. And you know, we have the changing area, we have porta potties so that you can bring your picnic down here and just enjoy the afternoon.
The attention to detail on the land here, as well as the newly created rapids in the water, is the result of a partnership. Stuart Nolan, the president of Crist Engineering in Little Rock and one of the architects behind the Whitewater Park's rapids, says the park wouldn't exist without those partners, including the nearly $2 million investment from the Walton Family Foundation. But he says the city's decision to accept ownership was critical as well.
And then the city's willingness to take it on, because there will be, you know, it's a significant commitment. I mean, I'm sure you've talked to Hayden and others with the city about that. I mean, this is a city park, so they're going to have to take care of it.
Holland Hayden, with the city, says efforts were made at every step of the process to keep the formerly undeveloped spot as natural as possible. Two rain gardens have been installed, and the lights in the parking lot have very focused downward beams to eliminate as much light pollution on the night sky as possible. And those lights work without electricity. They're solar-powered because there's no electricity here.
And the Siloam Springs Electric Department were the ones who put this in, and they've done a great job. They built the lights up high enough so that they'll withstand that flood in case that happens, which at some point the Illinois River will flood. So they're high enough up so that they're safe, but they're still solar and they provide great light.
Yesterday, while members of the Arkansas Canoe Club surfed over the new rapids repeatedly and city officials looked at the features, Delia Hawk was knee-deep in weeds. She's the executive director of the Illinois River Watershed Partnership, a nonprofit organization that's also been included in the planning of the park. She took the sneak preview as an opportunity to do some hands-on maintenance to the rain gardens that the IRWP has planted.
You know, if we could just raise weeds, we'd be silent. So what we've done here is a nice rain garden with native plants. And we've had just in the last 2 months, you know, periods of drought and some substantial rain. So what we're doing is just kind of taking the weeds that have popped up here and making sure our native plants get established and let their roots grow down deep, because they will be able to, you know, subsist during drought and times of rain. But they're all looking really good.
She says the park also has 275 new native trees and about 500 new native plants adjacent to parking lots, picnic tables, and the changing station. Most agree it will, however, be the newly created rapids in the Illinois River that will draw most people. Shane Siegel, the project engineer, says the already existing bedrock ledge was fundamental to the park's creation.
And that's why this spot was chosen by the Walton Family Foundation. That spot created a feature that's really close to where feature number two is right now, but obviously not man-made. And flow dependent and probably medium quality. And we were lucky enough to be able to come in and do all the hydraulics and change things around and try to maximize that hydraulic drop to create two features instead of one feature. And obviously all the amenities that go with it.
Shane, who says he's had a hand in creating many whitewater parks throughout the U.S., says this kind of work is about 50% art and 50%, his words, geeky engineering. Ron Swan, the president of TSP Contractors, oversaw the actual construction of the new features. Yesterday, during the sneak preview, he looked at kayakers taking their turns at the water and remarked the area looks quite a bit different now than it did 2 years ago.
There was quite a bit of overgrowth in this area, particularly as you got down into the trees and towards the river. Quite a bit of undeveloped, just fallow land to the east and west. And then, of course, the bridge was here, so it was quite a bit.
The old bridge, yeah.
The old bridge looked quite a bit different.
That old bridge has been removed, and a new one is under construction. Dan Daniels, who was quite busy getting wet most of yesterday, says he knows exactly how long it will take him to get to these rapids from his home on Dixon Street in Fayetteville.
Once they get the bridge finished and we can cross over, it'll be exactly 25 miles from Dixon and West.
Until then, it's not that much further for him to make it over for an afternoon.
It's a lot of fun out here. We've got a lot of dynamic features to play in and, you know, just a great learning spot, a good place to get a workout in. It's a lot of fun.
Shane Siegel, the project engineer, says he's pleased with what's been created, though already yesterday he was seeing minor tweaks that could be made. He says one of the top priorities in creating these engineer rapids was to remember the Illinois River has been here a long time and there's a responsibility.
And that's a balance. You know, we certainly have, there's critics out there that just say, leave the river alone. Don't ever touch the river. And then there's also people that have come up to me and said, look, you opened a whole new world to us. Just like the gentleman before me, we can create an environment that's more controlled than a natural wild river that's raging from a storm. And we can introduce people in a safer manner to come out to the river and hopefully appreciate it and enjoy it and get something out of it. And if nothing else, you know, have a good day and have fun. It's all about fun. Come enjoy it.
The official opening for the park will be June 28th, and it will include enough free food for the first 500 curious people. The park is scheduled to be open 7 days a week from an hour before sunrise to an hour after sunset. There is also a family swimming area away from the new rapids. And Tom Burrows with the American Canoe Association, who also teaches swift water rescue classes, offers one gentle reminder. These rapids are on a natural river. It's not an amusement park.
And even though there are sidewalks and places to walk down, it is critical that we still maintain good safety practices, especially always wearing a life jacket that's properly fitted and fastened.
You can learn more about the Siloam Springs Whitewater Recreation Park, including the best route to get there from downtown Siloam Springs, at either SiloamSprings.com or the City of Siloam Springs Facebook page. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
The Food Science Building at the University of Arkansas Agri Park looks much like its neighboring buildings, gray in color with a few neutral bricks. Inside, however, big things are happening. A small corner of the large building houses the Arkansas Food Innovation Center, the only one of its kind in the state. The small-scale facility is regulated by the FDA and aids to advance the value-added food industry by assisting with the startup of new food processing businesses by providing help through product development, providing kitchen space, to sales tips. Since opening in December of 2012, the center has helped countless businesses get started. A couple to note are the baby food maker Oh Baby Foods and Pink House Alchemy, both of which we have reported on here on Ozarks at Large. Today, there are around 30 groups and individuals who use these facilities to prepare, test, and label their products in preparation for sale. After donning a hairnet, I make my way into the kitchen of the Innovation Center, where Lynn and Gina Roberts of Roberts Family Farm in Westport were preparing Gina's salsa. Gina has been making and selling the spicy sauce to friends and family since 2007. Last year, the Roberts saw an opportunity to expand through the Fayetteville Farmers Market, though the market requires all products sold there to be processed in an USDA-inspected and approved kitchen, which is what led them here. Each Tuesday morning, beginning at 7, the Roberts carry in the necessary ingredients and start making salsa. The recipe, however, got a much earlier start, beginning with notes from Gina's grandmother.
So I kind of combined a lot of different things and put them together and then worked on each batch to create my own, to get my own, what I wanted in it and the taste of it. So
how long did it take to develop your recipe?
About 2 years to get just the exact amount of everything that we wanted. And so the first batch, because we used different types of peppers and I was experimenting with different peppers, and one of my batches I did for a kind of a contest, I used bell peppers, and I will never do that again. It just did not make, it didn't have the same taste as the hotter peppers do.
The Roberts try to grow all of the peppers they use in their family garden, from the serrano and jalapenos to the Tobago pepper, which Gina says has a habanero taste. Peppers that they aren't able to grow themselves, they buy locally from other farmers at the market or from a Hispanic grocery store in Springdale. The Roberts make a hot, medium, and mild salsa. Lynn says the level of spiciness depends on each individual pepper.
What we do, we can't set it up because all peppers are different. We make a batch, we taste it, and then label it. But we try to know what we're going to make. It doesn't always work that way. And I grow a jalapeno that's hotter than the serrano, but we don't have any right now.
As tomatoes are the main ingredient in salsa and each batch requires many, they use canned tomatoes as they're not able to grow or acquire enough locally. Three large industrial-sized cans go into each batch. Each batch, one case, or 12 to 13 pints. Today, they are making 8 batches, and cans of tomatoes on the counter bear the numbers of the batch they will be making. The U of A Center supplies many of the necessary pieces of equipment, but Gina brings in her personal food processor to chop the tomatoes. A longtime fan of national brand Pace Picante sauce, that is the consistency Gina is going for. The U of A sometimes supplies interns, and on this particular Tuesday, one is helping to chop the tomatoes, using a gloved hand to pull one at a time from the large cans and drop them into the processor. It's a messy job, and so she wears a disposable jacket to protect her clothes from red splatter. The chopped tomatoes go into a bowl with the other ingredients, properly measured by Gina ahead of time.
We have peppers and onions, and we chop those. And then we have tomatoes, and then our seasoning for it. And that's basically it. It's just onions, pepper, garlic is one. And I usually chop the onions, then I chop the peppers, and then we add the spices, and then the tomatoes. And we use approximately 3 cans of tomatoes per batch, and then the spices equal out the spices of what for each batch. And that's pretty much it.
Spices include cumin and chili powder. Each batch goes into its own large silver pot. And makes its way to the stove to boil for 30 minutes. Many homemade salsas never hit the heat, but in order to jar it, Gina says it has to be processed in this way. About 6 pots rest on the stovetop at various stages of the process, making their way around the stove as they advance through. When each has reached its time, Lynn dumps in a package of Sure Gel, which will thicken the salsa as well as provide the natural preservative citric acid. Part of the service provided by the UA Center is assistance with labeling. All ingredients are listed as well as nutrition facts, identical to those seen on other products found in a store. The U of A also helps with testing for the pH levels of acidified foods like salsa. Lynn relies on their help for now, but hopes to learn how to do it himself. A pH level below 4 means that microorganisms won't be able to grow on the product and is therefore safe for public sale and consumption. Once the Sure Gel has boiled the appropriate 2 minutes, the pot of salsa is removed from the heat using plastic, not cloth, because cloth can carry bacteria, and placed on the table for jarring. Gina shows one intern how to use a spoon and wide funnel to fill each pint-sized jar, leaving just a little room at the top.
They have a machine out there that we could run it through to fill the jar, but I'm afraid there again that it's going to squash it and make it smaller pieces because it's real fine.
The jars are then wiped down and lidded. Gina remembers her mother and father canning as she grew up, and she says it's something she's always done with vegetables from their garden. Once filled, the jars must get a bath in boiling water for 15 minutes, and then they're ready for labeling and sale. Consumers can find Gina's salsa on the shelves at the Harps in West Fork and at the Saturday Farmers Market in Fayetteville. The 8 batches they made today are more than their typical 6 in preparation for a busy day this week.
The first market, the opening market, he wasn't thinking that we needed to take very much. And he said 3 cases. And I said, no, this is where it's going to go. If we sell it, this is where it's going to sell. And I said, at least take three of each. Well, we sold out. We sold out before 2 o'clock, so that was a good sign.
The Arkansas Food Innovation Center is a fan of startups, and so the Roberts have been able to process here for no charge since last August. This month, however, they must start paying a fee, which is quite small in comparison to other options. You'll find Gina's salsa in the food court portion of the farmer's market, meaning the main ingredient in their product is not produced by them. You'll know it's Gina's salsa by the picture of Gina wearing overalls and a sombrero on the label. It's drawn by the Roberts' daughter. Gina also makes tote bags and aprons, which can also be purchased at the market. This is Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. 50 years ago this week, this song hit the top of the charts. We'll speak with the group that made it famous.
It surpassed everybody on the chart and knocked the Beatles out of first place.
The Dixie Cups, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF.
Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art presents A Taste for Modernism, featuring more than 60 works of art by European masters of modernism from the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Picasso, Matisse, Cezanne, and more are on exhibit until July 7th. More information is available at crystalbridges.org.
Theater Squared has announced its 2014-2015 season lineup, including the comedy One Man, Two Govness, the Pulitzer Prize-winning Proof, the family adventure Around the World in 80 Days, the premiere of Robert Ford's Look Away, and Tracy Lett's comedy drama Superior Donuts. Subscription, tickets, and more information available at 443-5600 or theater2, that's the number 2.org.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Lincoln.
Lincoln. We do have some prizes to hand out before we end today's show. Yesterday, we asked folks to just send us an email if they would like to be winners. Try to make it easy for our listeners to be winners. We are giving away 4 vouchers to any Northwest Arkansas Naturals baseball game, 4 vouchers to any local Malcolm movie theater, and 4 tickets to the Artisphere Festival Orchestra Finale Concert, which is at 8 p.m. Friday at the Walton Art Center. And our winner is Chad Thurman.
Congratulations, Chad.
Congratulations. We will be in touch with how to get you all of your prizes. If you did not win the tickets to the Artist Fair Festival Orchestra concert, I think there are still tickets available, and they start at $10, and you can go to waltonartscenter.org for more information on that.
Conscious Alliance is teaming up with Wakarusa Music Festival to host an Art That Feeds food drive Thursday through Sunday on Mulberry Mountain near Ozark. All food donations will benefit the River Valley Regional Food Bank. All patrons who donate 20 non-perishable food items will receive a free Wakarusa Music Festival poster created by artist Android Jones. Food donations will be collected at the Conscious Alliance Art That Feeds Gallery, which will be depicted on the Wakarusa Festival Guide and Map. For more information, just visit wakarusa.com.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Karnatz.
Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. We'll end today's show with some music by Messy Sparkles. The name of the song is Nick, and Messy Sparkles will be at Smoke and Barrel Tavern tonight in Fayetteville, along with Shivery Shakes. More information at smokeandbarrel.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a great Wednesday.